You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hi, and welcome to the Times Higher Education Issue Review podcast for the week of February 15th to the 21st. I'm Sarah Custer, and joining me today is Ellie Bothwell, our acting deputy news editor, Paul Jump, our features editor, and Rachel Pell's reporter. Hi, everyone.
Hello.
Thanks for joining me today. Should governments in the European Union pool their money to provide funding to university systems across the bloc? This is an idea behind a new proposal that some universities' leaders say could turbocharge the competitiveness of higher education in the region. Ellie will have the full details in a moment, along with news of a bold move in Canada to provide home fees for foreign PhDs. Could history become a subject of the past? Enrollments on history courses around the world are at best stagnating, but in many cases on the decline. Our feature this week asks historians what the future holds for their departments. Paul will tell us more on this later. Meanwhile, at the Times Higher Education Asia University Summits last week, all eyes were on the horizon as university leaders predicted Olympian-level battles in the race to make advancements in robotics and artificial intelligence. Rachel has returned from China and will give us the details on the discussions, including why university leaders in the region have welcomed the arrival of Trump and Brexit. So, Ellie, tell us about the European Excellence Initiative and who is behind it.
Yeah, so the background to this is obviously there are kind of several national excellence initiatives that various countries have set up with the aim of essentially sort of propelling a small number of universities in a particular system to kind of improve their research performance. So Germany has is kind of famously done this. It's invested about 4.6 billion euros in its excellence initiative since 2006. Lots of Asian countries have similar schemes, so China has one. And this new sort of proposal aims for a kind of Europe-wide excellence initiative. So the idea would be that national governments within the EU member states can choose whether or not to opt in for the initiative, and if so, that they would provide funding which would and the EU framework program and structural funds could also provide funding to this scheme. And it's been proposed by the German Rectors Conference and the Polish equivalent, the Conference of Rectors of Academic Schools in Poland. Basically, talks are on kind of ongoing at the moment, and then they're trying to see if the European Commission will help implement this.
And what's the aim of the project?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of mainly aimed at improving higher education systems that are maybe kind of less prestigious. So obviously, as I mentioned, countries like Germany, has its own excellence initiative, and it's kind of got a very well-renowned research system. I think the aim would be to help kind of improve research and innovation in countries that maybe kind of lack their own funding, that don't have a competitiveness at the moment. So they said that it would allow states with a kind of lower performing innovation landscape in particular to objectively assess the strengths and weaknesses of their national research systems, and thus achieve more focused development and become more internationally competitive.
It's worth saying that this is probably also a means to assuage some of those countries in the east of the continent who've always been rather annoyed by the fact that most of the European research funding goes west, because that's where all the best universities are. And the counter-argument to that was always, well, why don't you apply for structural funds to improve your universities and then you'd stand a better chance? So this kind of fits into that solution to it, rather than attempt, the other solution being obviously to reserve a certain proportion of research funding for Eastern European countries, but the Western nations, needless to say, have always very much opposed that solution.
There's been some broad support, according to the German and Polish rectors groups. They say there's been quite a lot of support within the sector. I spoke to Thomas Jürgensen at the European University Association, who said he thought it was a very kind of admirable proposal. But I also, there are obviously some critics. I spoke to Kurt Decatelier, who's Secretary General of the League of European Research Universities, which, it's a network of kind of highly prestigious universities in Europe. And he sort of said that he didn't really think it was necessary, that basically the EU already provides funding for similar aims. And he said, governments that aren't investing enough in their higher education systems can't just simply ask the EU for help. You know, they first should, or he said they should first get their research spending to 3% of their GDP before then calling on the EU.
And do you think this has anything to do with the UK leaving the European Union? Does Brexit have anything to do with this?
I don't think so, given that it's coming from Germany and Poland, and I imagine I don't think the UK would necessarily be able to kind of join this initiative if it's not able to get funding from the EU. I imagine the UK would be excluded from this sort of initiative.
It is kind of relevant in a sense, though, because one of the thoughts about Britain leaving the EU is that their voice, which was very much for merit-based research funding, will be lost, and the consequence of that might be that in the next framework programme there are, you know, measures to increase the proportion of funding that goes to the east of the continent.
Mm-hmm. So there's more space for those institutions to maybe step up and get a piece of the pie if the UK is out.
Well, it's not so much because the UK won't be applying for the funding. It's more that the way the framework programme is structured may be less merit-based, because the strong voice that Britain have for maintaining merit-based funding will be lost.
I see. Okay. Well, you can find out more about that proposal on page 6 of this week's magazine and also on timeshighereducation.com. Now, Ellie, you also spoke with the president of the University of Toronto, who has implemented quite a bold move in terms of PhD funding. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, so essentially they've announced that international PhD students will pay domestic level tuition fees from the next academic year, which is sort of part of Toronto's and Canada's sort of signal that it's a very kind of welcoming and open place, in contrast potentially to countries like the US, the UK, and the UK. But it also is actually a kind of direct response to the kind of relaxing of restrictions from Ontario's provincial government. So the provincial government provides grants to help universities cover domestic PhD education. And the universities in the province have been kind of arguing that they want to be able to use some of those grants to cover international level funding so they can increase their proportion of international students. And Ontario has kind of finally agreed, but said, you know, if you're going to use some of this money that we're providing for international students, and you can't also charge them international fees. So it's kind of a part of the sort of negotiations. They've agreed to charge international student domestic fees. I mean, I think the grant provides funding to about 15% of Toronto's total doctoral enrolment. So I think they had a choice of whether, you know, some international students that weren't covered by the grant would pay international level fees, but they decided to make it an across the board sort of announcement. And Brock University, which is also in the province, just this week has also announced that, in fact, it's going to fully cover the cost of tuition for international PhD students in sort of light of this move from Ontario as well.
Wow, so that's quite some leading decision making on the part of the province. Interesting. Well, you can find out more about that and read more of Ellie's interview with Merrick Gertler on page 16 of our magazine this week. Paul, over to you. Is it hard times for history departments everywhere?
Well, that's a good question. And I can't claim to have a definitive answer to that. This isn't a sort of global survey. We have got a few figures. Into Britain, the numbers are reasonably steady. I think probably the most interesting way to look at it is history degrees as a proportion of all degrees, because obviously the proportion of all degrees has gone up a lot over the years. So in terms of that proportion, it's kind of held steady. The US, it's less healthy. There, especially with bachelor's degrees, there has been quite a decline over the years, although it's not drastic. Again, Canada, we don't have definitive figures, but anecdotally, student numbers have gone down a bit there as well. So I think there is certainly a bit of a pattern, in the English-speaking world at least, of numbers at best holding up, and in many cases declining.
So for this piece, we've got contributors from Australia, Canada, the UK, and the US. And they make some pretty predictable arguments, I guess, in terms of defending history departments, speaking about their benefits compared to STEM degrees. But there are also some pretty nuanced arguments as well.
Well, I think, you know, the reason we commissioned this feature is partly because, you know, history is actually quite a topical subject at the moment, given everything that's going on in the world, particularly the rise of populism. Obviously, a lot of people are talking about historical parallels to that. On the other hand, you know, certain white supremacists sort of draw on history as well, or their, at least their interpretation of it, to justify their own particular views. So it's, you know, history has kind of been drawn into the mainstream in a way that it probably hasn't been previously, at least not in recent years. Although it's perhaps a bad reason overall, it nevertheless might act as a bit of a recruiting sergeant for history departments if people begin to see how culturally relevant history is.
And what have they said? There was one academic specifically who was speaking about kind of this clash of populist movements and history departments, especially on social media. And she was saying that that's something that historians are kind of battling with, or are making these complex ideas kind of digestible in the modern, on a modern platform.
That's right. Yeah, that's Rachel Moss from the University of Oxford. Yes, she she talks about one particular social media spat last year between white supremacists and a historian that all got very nasty. But yeah, her point is that historians certainly can't keep out of these things. If you do, that the sort of space will just be taken over by people that you don't want it to be taken over by. So it's very much incumbent on historians to kind of get into the modern world, at least in that sense, in that technological sense, and kind of get their expertise out there.
Yeah, and also hopefully help enrollments.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Great. Well, you can read more about the future of history departments on page 38 of our magazine and, of course, on timeshighereducation.com. Now, populist movements and specifically Trump and Brexit, it's not all grim in terms of perspectives, as you heard in China last week, Rachel. Tell us about why Asian university leaders see Trump and Brexit as maybe not such a bad thing.
It's really interesting hearing a different perspective on this. Obviously, at the summit, there were a high number of vice chancellors and university representatives from Asian universities. And speaking to Raj Kumar, who's the vice chancellor of the OP Jindal Global University in Delhi, he was positively quite, I wouldn't say gleeful about it. He said, he's very careful to say that UK universities and US universities have a really powerful reputation, and he doesn't think that will change worldwide. But he said that his own institution has already seen a trend in that the brightest students in India are opting to stay at home to do their studies. So his own university's had greater interest, particularly from universities or prospective university students coming from other regions of India who might once have looked to the UK and the US. Apparently they are a bit worried about the political climate. They're being put off by all the negative press around the Trump presidency and Brexit and what that might mean for visas in particular. So rather than go to, say, London or New York or wherever, they're going to Delhi, and they're still getting their travel fix, but they don't have to worry about any of that messy politics. So that was really interesting. A couple of other people waded in to say similar things. Paul Tam, who's the acting president and vice chancellor of the University of Hong Kong, he said they look at Brexit with a wry smile, which made me laugh. I think a similar story in that they recognise that there's a shift in international students wanting to look to other places for their studies. And he said, quite rightly, they're going to make the most of that opportunity.
It seemed like the crux of the discussions taking place at the summit were around this Olympian level competitiveness that universities are predicting to see in terms of the race to make advancements in robotics and in artificial intelligence.
Yeah, so there was a lot of debate around the so-called fourth industrial revolution and how that will shift competition. So Alice Guest gave a really interesting keynote speech about AI and how universities are using artificial intelligence, or rather, I think, how she's saying how they should be embracing it as something that's inevitable, rather than something to be afraid of. So she cited the example of Unilever, who've already started using algorithms to help them narrow down the recruitment process, which I asked her about afterwards. She suggested really it's inevitable that universities will adopt these same practices, which is fascinating. So Unilever, they already use algorithms to help select interviewees before they actually meet another human being. So whereas once a candidate might send off their CV and application form and a cover letter, all they do now is they click on a Facebook ad and they use details that are already online, like their LinkedIn profile, to be pre-selected, if you like. Then they'll go through a series of online games, sort of logic problems to solve, to help this automated system decide whether they're someone who might suit the role. And Alice Gass suggests that that's something that universities will also do, which on the one hand it feels like the natural next step, but it's interesting as well to think about what psychological effects that might have. I mean, if you get rejected by something that's not even human, how would you feel about that?
Yeah, and how much of a person can it really judge if we're basing it on an algorithm?
Right. Mm. I mean, we all know people who perhaps do really well on paper for a job or applying for university, but wouldn't do that well in an interview, and vice versa. Mm. So are you in danger then of biasing the whole system against a certain personality trait, for example?
It wasn't just university recruitment that they were talking about as well. I mean, there was this whole discussion led by Keith Burnett at the University of Sheffield about this race to make advancements. Who's leading the pack so far from your take?
Well, I think a lot of people would say at this point it's China, and not just between Asian countries, because their research and development expenditure is incredible. I learned at the summit that the budget for the National Science Foundation of China, it's 360 times what it was 30 years ago. So that gives you an idea of how much their spending has increased. The government's really behind science, and they're pushing, for example, the AI initiative, and preparing for the fourth revolution. They've also got a really youthful population. The brain drain is said to be almost over, so more and more young scientists are choosing to stay in China and focus their research on Chinese initiatives. So I think what the conversation was around in Shenzhen was that China's still got a way to go in terms of competing with the research turnover of the US, and obviously Singapore is still top-ranking Asian country in our rankings. But I think I found it really humbling to talk to people from across the world who all said how driven and ambitious China is. And what particularly summed it up was Keith Burnett talking about how essentially all of these countries are preparing for where research is going in the future. And China, to an extent, is laying the foundations, if you like. So, I mean, we already are all competing to partner up with countries like China, who are really far ahead in terms of robotics and AI research, which is interesting.
Fascinating. Well, you can read more about Rachel's time in Shenzhen with our coverage on page 14 and 15 in the magazine this week. That's all we've got for this issue review. Thank you very much for joining me, everyone.
Thank you.
Thanks.
We'll see you next week.
Bye.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.